From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Susie Hamilton held the House seat in North Carolina's 18th District for three terms and was recently elected to a fourth. She resigned near the end of January after new Democratic Governor Roy Cooper tapped her to lead the state's Department of Natural and Cultural Resources. Deb Butler easily won the appointment by the Democratic Party and took her oath of office on February 6th to represent the district, which covers parts of Brunswick and New Hanover counties. While this is her first time holding state office, it's not the first time she's had it in her sights. In 2012, she challenged Republican Senator Tom Goolsbee for his seat and lost. Representative Deb Butler is with us today in a pre-recorded interview, as she is currently in Raleigh during this year's long session on Wednesdays and Thursdays. Representative Butler, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. So happy to be with you today.
Some of you sent in questions before the taping of this show, and I will incorporate those as I can. But let's start with, how do you like being the newest member of the state legislature in the nearly month and a half since you took this seat? What have you learned?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I'm no longer the most junior. As we had another appointment, Representative Black was appointed a few days after I was. So I have some seniority, Rachel. Give me some cred.
All right, a little bit. So you've been there a month and a half now, and I'm sure it's been a pretty steep learning curve. But what do you know now that you didn't know a month and a half ago about this job?
You know, the interesting thing among many is that the General Assembly is a vibrant, active place. I mean, there are tons and tons of people coming and going and discussing the issues. And I don't know if this is always the case. It is right now, I could say that, to the point where I find myself having to sort of leave the office to actually get work done because constituents do visit. Special interest groups come by, lobbyists nonstop. So it is a buzz with activity in that building.
What is the heaviest lobbying effort going on right now?
You know, we have a couple of bills that seem to be generating a lot of spirited debate. One of them is it's kind of an optometrist versus ophthalmologist debate. There are certain laser procedures that I gather optometrists want to do that are currently being performed by ophthalmologists. And certainly they're staking out their territory, and it's a scope of services kind of issue. And I'm still studying that to determine whether or not I think, you know, there is a need for this service apparently in rural areas. And as you said at the top of the hour, I do serve part of Brunswick County, which is very rural in nature. And so access to services is always part of my analysis about issues like this.
And just to be clear, the difference between optometrists and ophthalmologists, the ophthalmologists are medical doctors, is that right?
Right.
Optometrists are not.
Yes, they're more, well, as they have pointed out to me, they have an entirely different set of educational standards than an optometrist. And yes, they are medical doctors.
So let's really start with an issue that continues to keep North Carolina in the national spotlight. And a listener actually asked about this as well, HB2. Listener Joanne says, what are the chances for a clean repeal of HB2? Now, she's clearly coming from a position on that. There are lots of supporters of that bill, which is part of the reason this has been such a sticky wicket in Raleigh and why the negotiations have been so complicated. So what would you like to see happen with it, and what's realistic?
Well, I'm with Joanne on this one. A clean repeal is really the only way to go with this. And let's understand one thing. This HB2 was a creation of the Republican-led leadership in Raleigh. They wrote the bill, passed the bill, and they have the power right now to repeal it unequivocally. Right now, today, they could do that. They've chosen not to, and I think that speaks to the chasm within their own party. There are ultra-conservatives in their caucus. There are a handful of moderates left, I think. And so the debate is within their own party about what should be done. Now, they are consulting us as Democrats because of that fracture. They need our votes now, which they don't need very often, I can point out. But they do need it on this. And again, we have had clean repeals offered. But so far, they have gone nowhere.
Do you see any movement on that happening this week? What's the next likely step?
As you well know, we are up against some serious deadlines. The NCAA is about to accept bids for athletic championships for the next 6 years. So if it's not done in the next several days, we will be out of luck for 6 years. So I have to say, Rachel, we have looked at a variety of what have been dubbed as compromise bills, but they come with so many strings attached, and they come with so much inherent discrimination that, you know, the governor said, look, my goal is to bring industry back to North Carolina. We are losing hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. So the governor—
And he's attributing that loss to HB2.
You bet. And he has said in unequivocal terms, I want to bring business back to North Carolina. I want to remove the stain on our reputation, and I want to end discrimination. And if a compromise bill doesn't accomplish those things, then we just can't get behind it.
There seems to be a movement afoot in the North Carolina state legislature and other states as well to reduce the control of local governments and return power to the state. And we saw that in clear HB2 is actually an example of that kind of movement passed almost exactly a year ago, which prevents municipalities from enacting their own anti-discrimination ordinances. And we saw it last week when legislators filed a bill to repeal the plastic bag ban, which is now in effect in the Outer Banks. So is this a correct read of that trend? And what does that mean in broader terms?
Well, you know, it seems so disingenuous because this is the party that's talked about local control, small government. And so it's counterintuitive to suggest that local decisions should now be made in Raleigh. So, again, the philosophy suits, but only when it suits, I guess. And so we see it. We saw it on the plastic bag repeal, like you just suggested. But it's not just that. Another perfect example is having district judge vacancies filled by the General Assembly. Now, that for at least 50 years has been the province of the governor. Same thing is true. We had a bill to reduce the size of the Court of Appeals. Now, any lawyer will tell you that the North Carolina Court of Appeals is the busiest court in the whole state. They need more judges, not fewer judges.
Hasn't there been an argument that the backlog of cases has been alleviated and so there really isn't a need for that large a panel?
Well, they would have you believe that. But when judges, having not talked to one judge, and that came out in testimony actually in the J4 committee that I was privileged to, having not spoken to one judge about that workload, I don't know how they know that. They're downloading some statistics from a website, but the truth is that those statistics do not consider motion practice, appeals, other types of issues. So if you ask the judges, they will tell you that they are incredibly overworked. And here's the backstory. Let's just talk about what it really is. There are three Court of Appeals judges who are facing mandatory retirement age, which is 72, in the next year or two. They are all Republicans. And if they retire, the appointment belongs to the governor at present. They don't want the governor to appoint those judges, even for a short term. Now, they have to be reelected, but they don't want the governor using his authority even for a few months to appoint those vacancies.
North Carolina also has a bill in the works that would penalize local governments in the form of withholding funds if they offer sanctuary to undocumented immigrants. Knowing your politics, I'm guessing you're against that bill. But do you understand the concerns of people who want to put a stop to governmental public resources going to people who have broken the law and who are here illegally?
Of course, I certainly do understand that, Rachel, and I think that's a valid complaint. Everybody recognizes that we need to create a legitimate and appropriate path to citizenship. People need to pay their fair share. If you're going to work in this society, if you are going to contribute and be a responsible member, as I think most immigrants want to do, you need a responsible, appropriate path to citizenship. And I think if we had that, we probably wouldn't be having these conversations. So immigration reform is necessary, but we can't do it at the expense of families. We can't have children living in fear that their parents aren't going to be there to pick them up at school. So we have to find some way of compromising on this issue that doesn't destroy families, that doesn't penalize hardworking people, and that does actually limit the number of, if there is a criminal element, I think it's overstated, but if there is a criminal element that has immigrated into this country, of course we can all agree that they need to not be here.
Do you think that Wilmington, since you're from New Hanover County, should Wilmington become a sanctuary city? Or would it be putting too many state resources in jeopardy?
You know, again, I don't know whether or not that is the issue. I feel like that label is already stigmatized. You know, people calling saying sanctuary city, and that's already a buzzword for, oh, here come the criminals. I don't believe that's true. Again, we want to find a way to protect families, to protect children who live in this environment and have their whole lives. We don't want to be seen as a fearful city. I heard a tutorial the other day about the immigration prison down in Lumpkin, Texas, I think it is, or Lumpkin, Alabama. It is a scary place. It is a private prison, and every prisoner means dollars down there. And I'm afraid of what that looks like. I don't like a country where people are destined to private prisons and just disappear without due process.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking with the second newest member of the North Carolina State Legislature, Representative Deb Butler. She's a Democrat from New Hanover County. She was appointed to fill Susie Hamilton's seat after Susie Hamilton joined Governor Cooper's cabinet. This is a pre-recorded interview due to Representative Butler's legislative schedule. When we return from this 90-second break, we're going to hear more about her goals for District 18, including the area of education. You're listening to Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, we're talking with Democratic Representative Deb Butler of New Hanover County, who was recently appointed to fill out Susie Hamilton's term after Hamilton was tapped by Governor Roy Cooper to lead the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources. This is a pre-recorded interview due to the fact that the General Assembly is eyeball deep in its long session. Representative Butler, just before we went to break, I promised we'd talk about education. Now, there are so many elements to that discussion, but let's start with the bill that was passed last session that put limits on class sizes. And this was one legislators talked about unintended consequences. School districts complained because they said there wasn't extra money put into the budget for additional teaching staff, but they still had to shrink class sizes. They said for that reason, they might have to cut programs like physical education or arts. Legislators have said that they want to relax class size limits. And Representative Frank Eiler of Brunswick County and Holly Grange of New Hanover County, both Republicans, have filed a bill to relax that rule. But according to a piece in the Star News, that bill is now in the Rules Committee, which is often the death of legislation.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's likely to happen there? And is there a divide over relaxing class size limits?
Well, no, there's not a divide on that. Here's the problem. Everyone in their right mind agrees that smaller class sizes are better. But you got to pay for it, Rachel. You can't just pie in the sky it. You have to pay for it. And that's the problem. The General Assembly, the Republican-led General Assembly, has not adequately funded education. And Representative Davis will fuss and argue with me on this point, but that is the fact. And so much so that every superintendent, when this bill came forward, ran to the General Assembly to say, we will have to raise taxes locally. We will have to build more schools. We will have to cut out these extracurricular programs, and we just can't do it. So, again, we went into hyper-fix mode to relax classroom sizes to give more authority and flexibility to local, superintendents to fix what the unintended consequences were.
You mentioned Representative Ted Davis, and you clashed with him very publicly at a recent legislative breakfast mm-hmm. in Wilmington. Mm-hmm. Local news organizations wrote about you butting heads, getting mm-hmm. into this heated exchange, and he is a Republican from New Hanover County. And since he's not here, I don't want to revisit the minutiae of the argument itself, but it really didn't sound like a friendly exchange. You're both representatives from New Hanover County. You're both in the state legislature with hopefully the best interests of southeastern North Carolina at heart. Do you see yourself cooperating with Ted Davis down the road? Is this sort of an augur of the future of this relationship?
No, I have great respect for Representative Davis. He has done much public service for this community. And yes, we do both have the best interest of the community at heart. We're just going to disagree on how we get there. And that's okay, because robust debate and exchange of ideas, I think, will provide the better result in the long run. So, again, I have the utmost respect for him. We're just going to disagree from time to time. He probably is not going to take it personally. I know I'm not. So.
And Governor Roy Cooper unveiled his budget proposal recently, which included money for teacher pay increases that he says could come from a budget surplus, which would mean no tax increase. What are you hearing in Raleigh about support for teacher pay increases?
You know, the great thing about this budget— well, there are a lot of great things about this budget, but, you know, a budget should espouse your values, and it should identify where you spend your money. And he has done just that with this budget. He proposes to increase teacher pay for the next couple of years by 5% each year, with a long-term goal of getting us to the national average. Now, I feel very sad that I'm having to say that. We are well below the national average in teacher pay. And let me put it to you this way. When you see Texas and Tennessee setting up recruitment stations in your state to lure your teachers away, you got a problem. So we have to fix that, and the governor is cognizant of that. His budget also calls for stipends for, supplies and that sort of thing. It also calls for raises for principals and reinstates some assistance. So there are a lot of great things in the budget for education.
And a lot of the criticism of the last round of teacher pay increases is that it addressed relatively new teachers. This wasn't rewarding teachers who had been at it for a number of years. Is this different that way?
Yes, I think so. I think you're going to see teachers with, we don't have tenure in North Carolina, but teachers who have longstanding service will benefit as well. Listen, here's a sad, sad story. If you see a teacher that you know teaches at high school, and then you go out to dinner on Saturday night and she's waiting tables, that's unconscionable to me.
Have you actually run into that?
I have. And I was on the verge of naming names, and I realized that was not appropriate. So I didn't. But, yes, and, that we cannot be proud of that here in North Carolina. We are the education state, Rachel. We used to be. I'm a product of public education, and we were the road state. We were the education state. We're the model of community college system across the nation. We're not that anymore.
So this was part of Governor Roy Cooper's budget that we're talking about. What are the chances with the Republican legislature that that element of his budget will get passed? I mean, certainly we know that it won't. The governor's budget is not going to be adopted.
Well, it is a wish list for sure. And I think he's shooting for the stars and hoping for a reasonable compromise. I do think the Republicans acknowledge that teachers are not being paid what they should be paid. And I think that's because the teachers have lobbied them to death and said, look at what, I'm doing here. I'm taking second jobs. I'm taking third jobs. I'm going to have to go do something else and forego my professional career if I don't get some relief. And I think they've made their voices heard even by the Republicans. And so I do think you'll see some teacher raises. Whether or not they rise to the level of Governor Cooper's budget, I don't know. But I do think we'll see some.
Now, we did see, before Governor Cooper took his oath of office, we saw a flurry of legislation get passed by the Republican-led legislature that essentially limited Governor Cooper's powers. What is the atmosphere like in Raleigh right now? And you, as a member of the minority party, you're a Democrat, how do you expect to exert any influence?
Well, you know, here's the thing. I feel strongly that regardless of who's in charge, we still have to talk loudly and clearly about the issues. Because when the folks understand, when citizens understand the ramifications of some of this legislation, they do come out. As I said in the first segment, the building is awash with energy. People are there. They're standing up for their rights. They are protesting. They are exercising every constitutional right they have. And so that's my job. I view that as my job, is to be a loud, strong voice, articulating the issues to keep people informed. And when we do that, as Democrats, we win. So that's my job, and that's what I plan to keep doing.
Will you be able to exert any influence over policy?
Well, I guess the short answer is not in the immediate future. We just don't have the votes that we need. But 2018 is coming, and redistricting is coming, and I think you're going to see a lot of energy behind these next elections. And if that is the case, then we're going to have more balance, and we need to be poised and ready to ameliorate some of the damage that we've seen.
I realize that the strategy of majority just squashing the minority or winning through simple majority has been the MO in not just the state legislature for many, many years, but it's also been a trend on Capitol Hill. I heard, this may be urban legend at this point, but I heard once upon a time, many generations ago, that legislators on Capitol Hill would work together. They would have friendships. they negotiated with each other, and they recognized that the person on the other side of the aisle was an important part of progress. Is that era gone forever?
Gosh, I hope not, Rachel, and I don't think so. If I've learned anything in my short month, it is that when we, you know, the pendulum swings, when Democrats are back in a position of authority, it is my sincere hope that I will be a senior member of that delegation, and we will work together. We will put this partisan stuff behind us, because it does not work to the advantage of the citizens. I've never heard one voter yet say, gosh, I wish it was more rancorous in Raleigh. No, we've got to do it better. I personally understand that lesson, and I think my fellow Democrats have too.
And so why can't it start now?
Well, it certainly should, but you can't compromise when people won't talk to you.
How much do you think about a strategic plan then for this term? We're talking about a two-year term, which isn't a lot of time before you start thinking about elections. So right now you've talked about being a voice for the minority. You've talked about clearly articulating the positions of Democratic lawmakers. You've talked about being a communicator, but it sounds like you don't see much room for compromise, because it doesn't sound like anybody's willing to compromise. So then strategy in the short term.
Well, let me back up one moment and say that there is still room for common effort. And in that, for example, we have, and we may be getting to this issue, but, you know, we have the horrible opioid crisis going on in New Hanover right now. So there, for example, this is an issue that we can all agree, and a bill has been put forward regarding this very thing. And certainly we are going to work together on that. There are also some other initiatives that I'm working with Representative Frank Eiler, because keep in mind, he represents part of Brunswick County and I represent part of Brunswick County. And so he and I are working on some collaborative efforts. So I don't want to paint the picture of doom and gloom entirely. Social issues we are challenged on, but there are a lot of local matters that we will find common ground on, and I'm anxious to do that.
Well, let's talk about that piece of legislation that you just referred to. I think it's the STOP Act.
That's right.
Which provides funding for treatment connected to substance abuse in response to the opioid epidemic. And we've had three recent discussions on Coastline about this. Medical professionals, frankly, were not exactly over the moon about this piece of legislation, because they said the restrictions that were likely to be put on prescribing practices, they weren't sure that that was the way to address the problem, meaning the doctor-patient relationship, you know, the doctor knows best, is that just going to add more cost to the whole process and potentially deprive people who really benefit from opioids of being able to get the medication they need?
Well, what the bill tries to do, and again, this is a little bit of an imperfect science, but what the bill tries to do, it tries to take a multifaceted approach. It tries to control prescribing information through an electronic database so that we can more easily track who's getting what in what quantities. It does some other things. It allows the opioid antagonists to be more widely prescribed to friends, to family. If you have a heroin addict in your family, you will now be able, I think, to get a prescription for an opioid antagonist so that perhaps you can avoid a catastrophic event. We feel like the multi-pronged approach on this thing is better, but more importantly than anything, there's a $10 million recurring expenditure that's going to be part of it if it gets passed for the year 2017 to 18 and in the subsequent year. So that's $10 million each year for substance abuse care. And that's, you know, a step in the right direction. So it does a variety of things, and limiting prescriptions is just one component. It actually, you know, it just requires they revisit the subject more frequently than possibly they would like. And it also limits how much medicine can be given for acute pain down to a 5-day window rather than, I think, a 10-day, which has kind of been standard. So it does a lot of different things. We'll see how effective it is. I'm a big believer in trying something and benchmarking it and seeing if it works. If it doesn't work, let's fix it.
And so if there are unintended consequences that hamper the ability of medical professionals to do their work.
Right. Nobody wants to do that, certainly. So let's try this. Let's see if it's effective. It may have to be revisited. But we've got to start somewhere because we're in a crisis.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today with North Carolina Representative Deb Butler, a Democrat from New Hanover County who was appointed last month to take over Susie Hamilton's seat in District 18, which covers part of New Hanover and Brunswick counties. Hamilton was appointed by Governor Roy Cooper to lead the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources after she was elected to a fourth term. This is a pre-recorded interview since the General Assembly is in session on Wednesdays and Thursdays. Representative Butler, this is a huge lifestyle change for you. You are a lawyer. Tell us first about your practice. What's your area of specialty?
Yes. Well, I have, I guess just because I am so invested in the historic district downtown, I love the historic district. It's been my home. Real estate, finance, contracts, leases, all anything that has to do with dirt is personally what I do. And I enjoy that. So it is a big lifestyle change. I'm away from my office, but I have incredibly good support staff. And without them, I would not be able to do this job.
And it is your own practice.
Correct.
So how is being a state legislator, you being gone most of the workday during the week, how is that going to impact your law practice?
Well, you know, you can do a lot remotely now that you used to not be able to do. And I try to concentrate my client meetings on Mondays and on Fridays. And I'm a lawyer on Saturdays and Sundays, too. So, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And this is such an important thing for me. I feel so strongly about my representation of this region that I'm going to make it work, whatever it takes.
And this is something that isn't new. As we mentioned earlier, you ran in 2012 to try to take Senator Tom Goolsbee's seat at the time. That didn't work out. But why did you want to become a state legislator?
You know, I feel like it's kind of a calling. It didn't come until late in my life, but that's only when I had the financial security and the ability to kind of take the blinders off and see what was happening around me. And I can't remember if it was Lily Tomlin who said this. Someone said, you know, she found herself one day saying, somebody should do something about all of this. And she said, then I realized I was somebody. So it's kind of that philosophy. You know, you can't look to others to do what you feel like you're capable of doing. And so that's it's sort of, I guess, snowballed at some point. I realized that I had an affinity for the issues, that I could absorb the material and take in data from a variety of sources to try to make good decisions. And So here I am.
And one of the things that we commonly hear from people who are freshmen in the state legislature is that, wow, is that learning curve steep? Wow, does a lot of stuff get thrown at you that you weren't expecting? Has it surprised you? Has it been a little intimidating?
Well, it is intimidating, at least initially. I recall my first comments on the chamber floor. I didn't rehearse them. I didn't script them out, as many freshmen would do. I just had one of those moments. I looked at my seatmate, who was Representative Bobby Richardson, and I said under my breath to her, I said, "Hold me back, Bobby." And she said, "Go ahead, girl, hit it." Anyway, so this was about judicial races and about how, in my opinion, a judge should be nonpartisan. And the Republican-led legislature has deemed it appropriate to put the R's and the D's back. And again, I think that's a bad idea.
And tell us why specifically.
I feel like judges should remain above the fray. And the words that I used on the floor were these. I said, listen, as a young trial lawyer, I watched judges twist arms and make forge compromise. And they're so good at it. You know, they always come to a settlement that is equally dissatisfactory to both parties, right? They know how to do that. So let's let them do it. If you put an R or a D beside their name, it necessarily pushes them farther to the right or farther to the left than they need to be. And so I voted against that bill, of course, and it lost. But now you're going to see probably R's and D's backed by the judges, and I think that's a bad idea. It's also a bad idea to have partisan folks drawing our voting districts. And I think that should be nonpartisan. And I voted for that bill. So we'll see.
Does that bill, you're talking about the racial gerrymandering that has gone on since the last census and the last round of redistricting, does that bill, is there any chance that in the near future there will be a nonpartisan process for drawing districts?
You know, surprisingly, I think we might be able to get together on that. It seemed to have a little bit of teeth as it was coming through, and some Republicans looked at it twice, so that's a good sign.
You're listening to Coastline. Representative Deb Butler is here today. She's talking about the recent unexpected turn her political career took after Susie Hamilton accepted a gubernatorial cabinet position. When we return in 90 seconds, we'll hear more from Representative Butler on her policy agenda. You're listening to Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Representative Deb Butler is with us today. She's talking about her policy agenda, what it's like being the second newest kid on the block in the General Assembly, and how she plans to work with the majority party. She was appointed by the Democratic Party last month to represent District 18, which is parts of Brunswick and New Hanover counties, after newly elected Susie Hamilton accepted a cabinet post from Governor Roy Cooper. Representative Butler, the Raleigh News and Observer wrote about the fact that you'll be the second openly gay state legislator in North Carolina this term. My first reaction in reading that was a little bit of surprise, frankly. Number one, that is still an identifier, still a noteworthy element of a person's biography. How do you feel about a major state newspaper making a point of that?
Well, you know, I guess because HB2 is ever present on people's minds and they somehow connect those dots, so I guess that's what makes it newsworthy. Honestly, you know, it's a generational issue. It's becoming less and less important all the time. And certainly, you know, New Hanover County is no stranger to that issue. Then-Senator Julia Bozeman was a courageous individual when she was candid about her sexuality. It became a non-issue. And in fact, when Woody White criticized her for it, he wound up losing the election. So I think people don't care about that stuff much anymore. As long as you're an effective legislator and you have integrity and you do the job you're appointed to do, I think that's really what matters.
And the other element of that point in that article was surprising, that you're only number two
well,
on that front. So what's behind that statistic?
I don't know. I guess I'm just braver than some. I don't know. Look, who knows? Well, I will say this. Legislators are not the, you know, giddiest, funniest, happiest people in the world. They're probably holding their cards close to their vest. I don't know. But it is immaterial. And the truth is, if I can champion that issue, if I can fight discrimination, that's all I've ever wanted to do in that vein. So that I'm fine with that.
Film incentives. Those are even a part of the legislative agenda for the city of Wilmington. And there was no support for this, or not enough support anyway, to keep the tax rebate structure before it got converted into this grant fund. We've since watched the lion's share of the film industry drop off in the state of North Carolina. We've heard legislators have filed different bills seeking to restructure it, to return it back to a tax rebate, to fund the grant a little more heftily. What's different now and what's likely to happen?
It is a tragedy what has happened to our film industry in this state. We have allowed Georgia to steal our film industry, plain and simple. It wasn't broken. It did not need fixing. It employed hundreds and thousands of people. It poured millions of dollars into our economy. So why on earth we upended that is still unbeknownst to me. You know, Republicans will say we don't pick winners and losers. We want all industry to sink or swim on its own merits. And yet those are the same folks who would hand a tax incentive to a Titan Cement, for example. So I find it very disingenuous that a tax incentive for Titan Cement is okay, but a tax incentive, and let's face it, that word has become stigmatized. You use the correct word, and that is a rebate. When a film came to North Carolina and spent millions of dollars that they could account for, this was not, we didn't give them the money and ask them to come. They came and they spent their money, and then if they could demonstrate that they spent it, they got a portion of it back. Listen, clean industry. We didn't have to build infrastructure for it. They left places better than they found it. I'm a big proponent of film. Under the Dome, gone. What was the other one? Sleepy Hollow, gone. So these big budget films are working in Georgia. All of our creative class that we cultivated over the last generation is basically gone, and it is very, very sad. And I don't know that we can get it back. With Governor Cooper's plan, I think we could still salvage that.
Are there any bills that are currently going through the process now that offer a little hope for the film industry?
You know, I've heard that the Senate might be working on something that would at least make television series feel more comfortable being here, meaning that it would their benefit would recur rather than having to apply for it year after year.
So they'd be able to plan because
right.
That's been part of an issue.
Right. And I think that's the only thing that I have heard that is actually being discussed. And I think that's emanating from the Senate side.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with North Carolina Representative Deb Butler, a Democrat from New Hanover County, who was appointed last month to take over Susie Hamilton's seat in District 18. This is a pre-recorded interview since the General Assembly is in session on Wednesdays and Thursdays. Some area legislators, Representative Butler, are working to put in place a dedicated fund for beach renourishment. First of all, where do you stand on this issue? And is it possible that coastal lawmakers who support this are going to run into the same resistance with legislators from other parts of the state? Or is this an easier sell as a statewide benefit?
I think the key is educating legislators from other places. And we have some statistics on our side. Of the 7 or 8 coastal counties that we have in North Carolina, 46% of the property owned on those beaches belongs to people in other parts of our state. So it's not just a coastal issue. They are a treasured resource across the state. And once we make legislators aware of that, they're a little more or a little less resistant, I should say, to working together to putting some sand back on the beach, which is what they say, and then it washes away. So we don't talk about that. We talk about stabilizing these dunes. We talk about making them resilient so that we don't have to reinvest as often. But listen, they are a dynamic force of nature, as we all know, and they have to be attended to.
Do you think that more coastal communities should be able to install hardened structures like terminal groins to help with that issue?
You know, that's a tough one because many coastal folks will tell, you know, the experts will tell you that if you put a terminal groin on the end of a beach, you just relocate the problem. I'm not a scientist. I try to listen to both sides of this issue. And again, it hasn't come up yet in this session. I'm sure I'm going to be hearing from the likes of Mike Giles and Tracy Scrabble and all these wonderful resources. But we have to protect our natural resources. And to that end, Frank Eiler, talking about cooperative efforts, Frank Eiler and I have been working on a bill that would create a half a cent sales tax in Brunswick County that is optional for the municipalities. And what it would do, it would tax prepared, pre-prepared meals. It would exempt groceries and other things, but that would be an option. It would be a tool in the toolbox for the municipalities in Brunswick County to re-nourish their beaches, to supplement that effort, and or to maintain their structures, bulkheads, and that sorts of things. So he and I are working together on that, and that's an illustration of something that we both care very much about.
And that's something that I think both Southport and Oak Island have sought. They're interested in taking advantage of that.
That's correct. And I represent places like Belleville and Navassa and Sandy Hook and places that are more rural. And that's why we wanted it to not be tied solely to beach renourishment, because there are other issues. I just walked the Belleville Walk with Mayor Mike Allen, in fact, on Saturday. Have you been? That park is fantastic. And so they are going to need that type of ability to maintain that boardwalk, perhaps, too.
This is a new development in Belleville. For folks who haven't been there, explain.
Well, it is a river walk over across from Belleville Elementary School. I went with two commissioners. Well, one of the commissioners drove the golf cart, Joe Briault. What a character that guy is.
He was instrumental in getting that done.
God, you can't deny him anything he wants. He is a force of nature. So he got me on the golf cart, terrified me a little bit, but it was a remarkable trip. And what he has done, what they have done over there, they have an open-air classroom right in the middle of an ecosystem that can pipe information all the way to all the Brunswick County schools. It's remarkable. And he approached Duke Power and said, give me some money. Well, they did. So, again, great things happening in Belleville. I'm going to go to Navassa on, I think it's Tuesday night. I'm going to make the drive back because we're having this huge meeting, you know, about their Superfund cleanup site there, the McGee Carr site. And that is the biggest issue, $98 million worth of cleanup and reinvestment getting ready to happen in Navassa. So that's worth the trip to me. I'm going to, Rep Deb is going to drive back from Raleigh to make sure that I understand that process and what they're doing.
And where is that $98 million coming from?
You know, it is a trust fund settlement. It is not well, let's not talk about the EPA right now, Rachel, because that may or may not be here by the time we get around to cleaning up Navassa. But this comes from, they are dedicated funds from a lawsuit settlement, and they are in trust. So the money is there, and that work is going to be done. We just got to make sure it's done in a way that satisfies the residents of Navassa.
And what is the state's role in that project?
You know, I'm going to see the players on Tuesday night and understand the lineup. I think a lot of the oversight is federal, and I think a lot of the oversight, I think there's a layer from the Department of Environmental, DEQ, Environmental Quality, will be involved too. So I'm going to go on Tuesday and be visible and discuss, get the mayor's opinion. Mayor Ulysses Willis is there, will be there for sure, and get an opportunity to let him know. I made a pledge, Rachel, when I was appointed, that I would not neglect Brunswick County. I think they sometimes feel like the redheaded stepchild, and so I want to make sure that they understand that I care about their needs as well.
And that raises a really important point. It's something that we've asked about before. What is the difference between the interests of constituents in Brunswick County versus the interests of your New Hanover County constituents?
Well, you know, we talk about this a lot. It's the rural versus urban divide. And because the district is drawn the way it is, you have folks that are extraordinarily rural on the one hand and folks that are extraordinarily urban on the other. I think the interest in large part dovetail in the sense that we want jobs that pay a living wage. We want our children to be well-educated. We don't want a pipeline to prison, as we often talk about. And we want clean environment. So many of the issues are the same. How we get there in different environments might look a little different. So I'm interested in learning from both points of view.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with North Carolina Representative Deb Butler. She's representing District 18, which includes parts of Brunswick and New Hanover County. This is a pre-recorded interview since the General Assembly is in session when Coastline usually airs live. Let's talk about Medicaid expansion. That might be something that for the near term is completely off the table, but it's, of course, as we know, historically not even been entertained in the state of North Carolina. The GOP-led legislature has been roundly opposed to this since it was proposed by the Obama administration. Do you support expanding Medicaid? Why? And is that off the table for the near term?
Yeah, I do support it, Rachel, because, you know, in back to Governor Cooper's budget would involve a Medicaid expansion that would expand coverage to 624,000 North Carolinians. You know, we have extraordinarily high insurance premiums here in North Carolina. And part of the reason is because we did not do the Medicaid expansion. And we have kind of stymied competition here. So people will say now, well, with the Trump victory, we wouldn't have had it for long anyway. And perhaps we would have had to make up the difference from a budgetary point of view. I'm a big fan in taking the money with no strings attached. Even if you have to tighten your belt afterwards, it would have been a good thing for North Carolina. It worked well in other states who did avail themselves of it. And so in the short term, I do think it is probably a non-starter for this legislation. But I hope that we see it come back around in the coming years because it is a valuable, valuable tool. And it protects North Carolinians that are currently non-protected.
We have just about 3 minutes left, 4 minutes. You're now looking back on your completed term. What is different because you had a presence in Raleigh for these last couple of years? What has changed because of you?
I think I'm going to reflect on the countless individuals who have already come up to me and said, you know, I know that you are fighting an uphill battle. And I know that the deck is kind of stacked against you right now. But you are giving voice and you are saying the things that I am thinking. And I take comfort and pride in knowing that my representative is walking into the lion's den unafraid and advocating for me. So there's great reward in that, Rachel. I mean, again, we don't know, honestly, whether we're going to be running in 2017 or in 2018. These districts, it's still possible that we will have an election in 2017. My term could be 9 months or it could be 10 years. We just don't know. But I will always stand up for my district. I will always fight tooth and nail. And I won't be a retiring flower. And I know we might butt heads sometimes, but that's okay. If we're speaking truth and we are advocating for North Carolinians, then we'll just do that.
And give us a quick update on where that is from a judicial standpoint. There was one point that new elections were ordered by a panel of judges, and now where is that?
Well, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals mandated that our districts, many of them, were illegal racial gerrymanders and would have to be redrawn by March 15th, actually. But the Supreme Court has stayed or put a hold on that for the time being. And with every passing day, it makes it less likely that we will have those elections in 2017. Still a possibility, less likely every day. But there will be new districts in 2018. The playing field will be leveled. And when we do that, we are going to see more balance in the North Carolina legislature. So my feeling is that in 2018, you're going to see a different composition up there. And by that time, Rachel, I won't be the second most junior. I will be right in the middle of the pack, and I'll have a whole lot more experience under my belt. But anyway, I plan to do the job to the best of my ability, regardless of my stature.
Was there any advice that Susie Hamilton gave you before she headed into the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources?
Most of that I can't repeat, Rachel. but I'll tell you one thing. A legislator told me, he said, every day the things you do affect the lives of 10 million North Carolinians, and I'll never forget it.
That's this edition of Coastline. Representative Deb Butler, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rachel.
Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org or get the podcast from iTunes. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.